Good evening. It is March the 7th, 2019, and this is your friend Dan in Little Saigon, Seattle, which, if you don't know, is really just a sub-neighborhood on the eastern periphery of the International District, also known as Chinatown, or yeah, Chinatown here in Seattle. I live not too far from Seattle University, not too far from Broadway and Capitol Hill. I don't need to give you my address, not that it would matter, but yeah, here I am. So today I was walking to the store to buy some crap, and that's a fairly good description. And a woman was in this on the other side of the street on 12th Avenue screaming. And I don't mean screaming at somebody. There was no particular person this woman was screaming at. She looked to be about in her 30s, African American. She didn't necessarily fit into some category like, oh yeah, this person's on drugs or not on drugs. This person has a mental issue. I mean, if you heard her screaming, you'd say, well, she sounds crazy, Dan. So she must be crazy. And in that sort of operational sense, that kind of implicit, empirical sense, she was certainly kind of deranged. She was screaming and yelling at anybody who would look her way, and she was screaming and yelling in every direction. A lot of stuff that just sounded crazy. So, here in Little Saigon, that is not a unique occurrence. And if you live in a city anywhere across the United States, and who knows, likely the entire world, and you live in a part of town that isn't necessarily, well, how can I put this? If you live in the part of town which technically represents much of your town, because I'm sorry, it's a numbers problem and most of you are not rich. If you live in that part of town that isn't so rich and kind of on the periphery of a lot of poverty, this type of phenomena is not that rare. I see it a lot here in Little Saigon. And I tend to be a hermit. Another word for hermit in the city is shut-in. It's not so much that I am afraid of going outside. It's more that I just don't have a lot of reasons to, other than to go for a walk for exercise. The last few weeks we've had some snow, and I just haven't really felt like going outside. But yeah, this woman, she looked attractive. She wasn't, she looked like someone who, in a slightly different set of clothes, I would meet at Microsoft or Amazon or some other place working some software job. But on this particular day, this, young African American woman was simply screaming. Last summer, when I was living here, there is no air conditioning in the building. And the reason why there's no air conditioning, it makes logical sense. For the most part, the summers in Seattle traditionally never got that hot. I don't know. In the last 10 or so, 10 or so, or 15 or 20 years, that's kind of changed a bit. But yeah, when I was growing up, air conditioning in Washington, in Western Washington, where I grew up, not Eastern Washington, not the desert, but Western Washington, it just wasn't really a thing. You didn't need air conditioning. But I live on the fifth floor here, and heat does travel upwards and whatnot. And last summer, I had to keep my window open a lot. And yeah, I would hear a lot of screams in the night, a lot of angry fighting. The building I live in is really right next to or not far from a homeless shelter. And yeah, I'd hear people down there at the homeless shelter screaming and fighting in the night. And you would wonder, does that make you upset? And actually, it doesn't. I have a weird response to it, and it's a bit of a strange response for some people. But for me, it makes sense. I actually kind of smile. Like, here's the deal. For many, many years now, I have been convinced that despite all of the propaganda and all of the news shows and all the Business Saturday roundtables on Fox Newses and CNNs and NPRs and other bullshit, I have had a sense that things are falling apart. And yes, the powers that be or whomever or whatever controls the great rat cage that we're all stuck in, I don't know what their plans are, but they do try to convince us everything is fine. But if you have eyes to see, and you're not looking at your smart device, you probably see some of the things I've seen. And you can say, well, Dan, clearly the reason why society is falling apart, it's just quite obvious, and you must be stupid, Dan. It's because of the fucking homeless people. Now, I don't step back too far or too far forward and slap a person in the face when they say stupid shit like this, but this is in general the basic rationalization of many of the morons that live in Seattle. The reason why we're having problems is because of homeless people. It's not so much that the homeless people are being produced by a broken economy and a society that's going sideways. No, 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 Dan. The homeless people showed up and all of a sudden everything's broken. Now, I would say if you've had any background in predicate logic, if you know how to interpret statistics, if you're a reasonably intelligent person with respect to topics of causality, cause and effect, you would have to admit that only through transcendental reasoning could someone presume that the homeless are causing the problems. But a rational person with a little bit of a brain that's not too infused with, you know, aluminum from the sky or fluoride from the water or whatever other shit they get from their yearly or bi-yearly flu shot, assuming that your frontal lobe still operates in such a way that you have the ability of metacognition and consciousness and whatnot, you probably would toss those stupid arguments out the window. You'd realize that, yeah, you know, maybe Dan has a point here. Maybe society's not falling apart because of all the homeless people. Maybe the homeless people are another sign that shit is falling apart. But don't you dare make that argument in the nice neighborhoods of Seattle. Don't you dare make that argument at the Monday morning breakfast in Northgate where all the realtors meet at some nice little diner to have their eggs and coffee and to talk about how, you know, it's just a little gully. It's a little gully. And here's the thing, folks, guys, human beings, people. If Donald Trump jawbones and twists the arm of Powell as if that's really a thing and not more theater, if Donald Trump gets his way, there is going to be a massive, massive infusion of hot money sometime in the next 6 to 9 months. It's going to happen. Okay? Quantitative easing will restart. They might rename it. They might call it modern monetary theory or helicopter money. They might give it some fancy name. Maybe part of it will come in the guise of some major infrastructure project where 15 or 20 guys can do the job of two people blocking traffic most days of the week. We all remember the summer of 2010, you fucks. Recovery summer. That's what the vice president called it. Shit, that's almost, what, 9 years ago? Yeah, 9 years ago. But I think if you have common sense and you're not sitting at the realtor round table on Monday mornings eating your eggs and coffee, you probably understand what I understand, that yes, there's going to be a massive, massive debasement of the dollar. I mean, I don't think it'll immediately cause the dollar to lose its value, but eventually it probably will. It's just a question of whose problem it is. Is it Donald Trump's problem? Is it Chairman Powell's problem at the Federal Reserve? Or is it just somebody's problem in the future? But make no mistake. The only solution the addict knows, when an addict is getting all itchy and scratchy, when the addict is getting nausea and the stomach is tightening, when the addict is getting headaches and going through withdrawals, the easiest solution for the addict is to get more drugs. The addict's only solution to every problem is get more drugs, and the central banker's only solution to pretty much every fucking economic problem over the last century, other than just fucking with, you know, the interest rates, which they love to do up or down, their other favorite solution is just print more money. Get more cash out there. And whether it's the Federal Reserve or the federal government or both, certainly since 2008, that is the only solution. Every year after 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, every one of those years, Ben Bernanke would say, well, this is a temporary thing, and sometime in the next year, we're going to wind down the quantitative easing. But keep in mind, there was a TARP 1 and a TARP 2. There was a QE 1, 2, and 3, right? Or maybe there wasn't a 3, maybe that's what's coming, but I think QE 4 is what's coming. The fact that we would lose count on the quantitative easing programs kind of gets to my fucking point here. There was Operation Twist, Part 2. I think the first one was in the 1960s. And then, yes, they did the whole short-dated, long-dated swap bond bullshit back in, I think, 2012 or 2011. That didn't work out so good, so they had to do QE3. Or I think it was QE2. The point is, fuck. The addict only knows. The addict only knows one solution to every problem. That's more drugs. The Keynesian economist only knows one solution to every economic recession or depression. Spend more money. And this, in my opinion, is also part of the madness. If this podcast has a theme, it is the theme of madness, of insanity. You know, we can all mock the homeless woman in the street screaming out at the world. And we can pretend we have an answer to that. Well, that woman is mentally ill. That woman is crazy. That woman is on drugs. But when I looked at this woman today, she didn't look like she was on drugs. She also, I mean, when I say she didn't look crazy, her clothes look fine. She looked like she'd been taking care of herself the best that you can in the streets. She just seemed like she lost it. And again, you know, these types of random behaviors, right? You know, people screaming, getting upset. You must be crazy because everything's so fucking great. If you read the fucking bullshit that comes out of all the think tanks, we're all supposed to be so fucking awesome right now. Everything's so fucking great, but what if that's a lie? I'm going to a job interview tomorrow, and the best advice I can give to myself is, Dan, put on your acting face. Pretend to be that other Dan, the Dan from 10 or 15 years ago. Smile and joke and be clever and be professional. Get the job. And if I'm on my game, and there is at least a 70% chance I will be on my game, I think there's a 50-50 chance I will get the job. But keep in mind, the product rule applies, which means you multiply the 0.5 by the 0.7 to get the real probability. Which, in my view, with minor adjustments in the universe of product rule and whatnot, looks about 25 to 30%. But again, that depends upon, you know, me, ultimately, having the right attitude. I don't know. There's a quote I'm fond of, and I've mentioned it in other podcasts, but I feel it's worth mentioning again. Excuse me, my throat's a little bit scratchy. And this quote goes something like this. And again, this quote's often referred to as anonymous in its source. Some people think it's applied to certain people, but it might simply be an anonymous quote. But the quote goes something like this. Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. And in some sense, even as a Christian, this makes sense to me. Like when I say to myself, okay, clearly this is coming from a polytheistic perspective, but because again, you know, God's plural, but reading my Old and New Testament, and especially my Old, I gotta tell you, when God is about to wipe the human race away, there's a lot of madness that often precedes it, whether it's a big time wipe away or a small time. Big time being the flood, small time being something like Sodom. When God is ready to chastise a group of people, whether he causes the madness or the madness is the result of their behaviors is kind of an open question. But it does appear to me that people en masse go kind of crazy before God's fist hits the earth. Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. Now you can also say, well, Dan, I don't notice a lot of crazy. I live on Sweetheart Avenue, in Sunshine Town, in Happyville County, and everything's fine. The temperature's always 70 degrees. Everybody's on their fucking Prozac. It's really great. We're all good. And that might be true too. But I've had a few experiences in the last few years that leads me to believe that might not be true. One of the things they teach you in the theory of politeness is that it is polite to not talk about personal issues that are quote-unquote negative or sad. I had a sibling that was in the Greek system, and if you want to know what the Greek system is, that's the whole sorority fraternity system. This particular sibling was in a sorority, and I remember at one point it seemed as if, you know, her personality had been swapped because she would get angry with people. Well, you shouldn't talk about that. That's not polite. And this is when she was much younger. This was when she was so young that having a serious fucking opinion about what people should fucking talk about doesn't seem quite so relevant coming from a 20-year-old. No offense, or a 19-year-old. Like, really? You're 19. You're like 4 or 5 years older than me, and you're trying to explain to me the wider aspects and features of Miss Marple and the various means by which you should, you know, be polite and blah, 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 because old Fuzzy Cuddles English book on proper, you know, proper behaviors of young men and women was your assigned reading this last quarter at the University of Washington. I don't give a fuck. I don't care about Miss Fuzzy Cuddle or the rules of proper behavior. Do I think people should treat each other decently? Of course. Do I think it's good to be polite and gracious? Yes. Do I get into the massive customs and weirdness of polite society, which really means people with money usually? Not so much. One could argue that that kind of politeness requires money. And one could also argue that that kind of politeness is a requirement of money just because everyone's out to get you, right? Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. I will not claim to have been a great student in graduate school. Whole nother topic for another day. I think at times I was good, other times I was mediocre. I was studying Russian history, Russian military history, World War II. That's as much as I want to talk about that right now. And that was like more than 20 years ago. But in one of my graduate courses in historiography, I came across a paper. The title of the paper was Toward a Theory of Revolution. It was published in 1962. And the author was Professor Davies. And here's the thing, if you want to read something that will tell you, in my opinion, everything you need to know about what's happening right now to society in America, and frankly, other places as well, and what's about to happen, this is a great paper. I think Davies more or less nailed it, and I think it's one of the reasons why this paper and his theory gets so buried. One of the things I've learned in the last decade, ideas that truly threaten the status quo, And guess what? Marxism ain't one of them, folks. Ideas that truly threaten the status quo are buried by the status quo. It is one of the features of power. People in power do not want you thinking thoughts that don't support, you know, the power structure. Well, Davies' theory was really quite simple, and I've discussed it before, but I'll discuss it again. If you live in a society that's been historically poor, which means it was poor 1,000 years ago, it was poor 100 years ago, it's currently poor, and everyone expects to be poor 100 years from now, but it's stable poor, which means there's no great losses beyond where you're at, and there are no great gains. For the most part, according to Davies, there is not a lot of social instability. And if you live in a society that's been historically rich, which means it was rich 1,000 years ago, it's rich 100 years ago, it is recently rich, rich today, and will be rich tomorrow, one hopes, according to Davies, you don't really have a lot of social instability. Where you see the social instability, according to Davies, is when a society undergoes a rapid increase in the standard of living and the average wealth distribution. So, like, for example, in the 100 years that preceded the French Revolution, the French people, and specifically the French middle class, experienced an increase in wealth. Now, there was a setback, however, and this is the key. In the 1760s, the French fought some wars and then later got involved in the American Revolution. And these wars caused issues, and the French government had to increase taxes. They used tax farmers. I don't want to go into what a tax farmer is. But the bottom line is they used thieves to collect money. That's how it worked. And the economy suffered. And so even though technically in 1789, the average French peasant was better off than the average French peasant in 1689, 100 years earlier, it didn't fucking matter. Because what they knew were the last 15 or 20 years. And in those 20 or 30 years, they saw their society get worse and worse. They saw their outcomes get worse and worse. They'd experienced an increase in wealth, and then they saw it slowly and then rapidly going away. If you've never been Australian rappelling, and again, all it is rappelling where you're facing down, Aussie style. If you've never done Aussie style rappelling, it's a lot like that. All you see is the going down. It's fucking irrelevant that on the other side of the mountain, you're still further up than all the poor people who are way down at the bottom. Because what you're seeing is the downside. And according to Davies, and if Davies is right, that downside experience is where you have revolution, civil war, social instability. Or another way of putting it, you have a lot of people just starting to go nuts, like the woman in the street. And you could argue, well, Dan, you know, it's not the 19th or 18th century. It isn't 1917. We're so much better today at controlling the minds of men and programming them and using drugs on them. That sort of thing could not happen today, Dan. And you could say that. I mean, make the argument, of course. It is a slightly better argument than the Dan, homeless people are causing the economic problems argument. I mean, that's a silly fucking argument. Really silly. The argument that somehow our government would be better at maintaining stability is at least slightly better. It is true. Our government and many governments around the world spend a lot of money on militarizing police, on developing technology for crowd control. They have systems, microwave systems, that will burn or at least make you feel like your skin is being burnt if you're part of a protest or a quote-unquote riot. So they do have a lot of technology, and certainly when it comes to prescribing drugs, holy fuck, there is no fucking shame, folks. I mean, I don't think it's implausible that at some point, especially given all the fucking ire towards anti-vaccination people, at some point they're going to say, well, shit, It's just plain wrong for anybody to be sad or depressed or angry or crazy. Ergo, if you live in America as a citizen and we decide that you're sad or depressed or angry or crazy, we're going to put you on a drug, and that won't be a choice. Why wouldn't they go there? If they're going to tell people that you have no choice to vaccinate, why the fuck would they stop there? Why wouldn't they say, well, shit, Dan or Bob or Steve or Mary or Jennifer or Patricia, you seem sad and upset. You seem angry. According to the new insurance laws, if you want insurance, you have to go on Prozac 17 or Extractafil or Bizulet or Remulai or Gombula 7 or whatever fucking chemical they'll shove into your brain case. Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. I think that's worth pondering. I think Davies was right. I think, it's not impossible to manage a setback. Setbacks occur. But the reason why setbacks impact people, both on a personal level and on a societal level, is because they experience the ascent. In the case of the United States, it's like Henry Luce's article, The American Century. If you haven't read it, you need to fucking read it. And of course, there's a lot of conspiratorial bullshit around Life magazine and Henry Luce, but I'll leave it up to you. That's Luce spelled Luce, Henry Luce, The American Century. I think he wrote that in 1940, or at least around that time. But again, there is this part of American history, especially the first 2 decades after World War II, where people would say, holy fuck, Dan, this is so fucking amazing. We're so successful. Sure, we had to drop a couple atom bombs on Asian cities with a high Christian population. Sure, we had to let, that crazy motherfucker Bomber Harris bludgeon every major city and industrial center in Germany to dust. Yes, General LeMay needed to strategically firebomb all sorts of cities in Japan, Tokyo, and whatnot, and already we mentioned the nukes, fuck. But yeah, after we got done erasing a lot of civilization, and then, cordoning off, creating that wall between ourselves and the Soviet bloc, yeah, for a couple decades we did well. We printed money, we gave that money to Europeans and Japanese and all sorts of people at a nice, affordable interest rate. And they took that money, that credit card, and they bought our shit. And for about 20 years, the American dream, the American middle class, seemed like a real fucking thing. But that only lasted about 20 years, folks. It really did. About 20, maybe 25 years. By 1970, that dream started to go bust, big time. Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. I know I've repeated that quote a few times in this podcast, and I know that you may be asking yourself, Dan, are you crazy? Well, before you ask me if I'm crazy, ask yourself if you're crazy. I can't speak to that. I don't know. I don't have a means to interpret that, but it's worth asking. Do I notice a lot more people losing it? Yeah. Have I, in certain circumstances in the last couple of years, lost it a little? I have to admit, I have. I have my own reasons. I have my own rationalizations. It's like the case with that fucker at my last contract who kept touching me. I don't know why he felt the need to touch me. I don't know what the fuck point he thought in his head he was making. And I don't know why everyone on that weird fucking Stepford Wife software project thought it was okay. But yeah, it gets to a point where even Dan. And that's funny because you probably all think I'm crazy. But even Dan will say to himself, fuck this. I'm going to lose it a little. if this guy is going to read me the riot act in public instead of finding a private place, which is what actual professional software engineer managers do, and not jerk ass H-1B visa, sorry, fuck you. If he's going to do this, then why don't I let myself do the same? You see, this was a case of crazy meeting crazy. This person was behaving in a crazy way, an authoritarian, tyrannical way, in a context of professionals when he should have been acting like basically a leader and instead behaved like a fucking ruler. Well, I decided that if this fucker was going to behave in a crazy ass way, then Dan, why don't you behave in exactly and precisely the same way? Now, that kind of reasoning, although it sort of makes a kind of moral sense in the balancing of scales, is not very practical if you want to keep working in the Seattle area. Sure as shit, I hope I have the right attitude tomorrow for my wonderful interview. I holy fuck, I hope, I'm there. And if they ask me, how, do you work well with offshore teams? And I'll say, oh fuck, I won't say fuck. I'll say, yes, I love working with offshore teams. I've worked remotely. I have no problem dialing into my Microsoft corporate account at 2 a.m. to talk to somebody, in Beijing or Shanghai or Bangalore or Mumbai. I don't give a fuck, and I won't say fuck. I'll do it, and I'll be positive. But it's going to take every ounce of energy I can muster psychologically to sit in that room and have a normal conversation where the word normal no longer fucking applies. Those whom the gods are about to destroy, they first make mad. Something to think about on this Thursday night, and if you don't hear from me, have a happy Friday tomorrow.